So sometimes when you hear meditation instruction, if you've heard it before, you might just go on automatic pilot and never hear it again. But actually, it's really helpful to be awake through the whole thing and just hear it as if you're hearing it for the first time. So there are some new people here that may have heard meditation instruction before, but this would be a refresher. And it may sound pretty new if you haven't heard it for a while. So this is called shamatha meditation. And the translation of that word, which is a Sanskrit word, is peaceful abiding. And it is a way or technique of just being in the present moment. That's the whole point, is just being here, at this very moment, just being here. It sounds extremely easy, and if you've tried it, you know the mind goes off very quickly. But one of the most important things, I think, in terms of meditation is that we realize that that isn't actually a problem. At first, people feel like, I'm doing it wrong. I can't follow the technique. But the mind is active and the mind does think. And what we're doing in meditation is actually taming the mind so that we can be present and not off in some fantasy world, in the past, in the future, but that we can actually be with our experience at the moment, right here, in this very place. And also another aspect of meditation that I think is really important is that there's a quality of equanimity about the practice. So instead of judging yourself, I'm a bad meditator, I never can actually do this, I'm always wandering around, you can just drop that, and whatever thought arises, you just recognize it and come back to the breath. So now I'll go through the main 3 points of meditation. And one way to remember this, and you can actually give yourself this meditation instruction when you're sitting at home, or if you start wandering too much, you can go through it yourself. And the easy way to remember it is body, breath, and mind. So the simplest instruction of body is basically an upright posture, as much as you're able to do that. And we're not forcing anything or exaggerating our posture in a certain way. It should be more or less relaxed within that upright quality. So upright, but there's a sense of relaxation as well. It's as if you're sitting on the earth and your seat is the earth, whether it's in a chair or on a cushion, whatever you're using as support, that represents the earth. So you take your seat, legs can be crossed in front if you're on the floor. If you're sitting in a chair, they can be parallel. And just on the ground, there's a sense of groundedness. Hands can rest naturally on the thighs. That's an easy, uncomplicated position. Back is straight with natural curves. Chin slightly tucked in. Eyes open and lowered down. so that they're not focused, but they are, you are actually gazing lightly in front of you. And having a lowered gaze helps us to not be so distracted. The mouth is slightly open to relax the jaw. And the reason we work with open eyes in this technique is because we're learning to be mindful of the world around us as well as our meditation practice. And it helps us to learn to just be awake whatever we're doing. But the gaze is soft, you're not staring. So those are 6 points of posture. And then we work with the breath as the object or focal object of our meditation practice. And that keeps us in this place as well as in our body. When we breathe, our body is, we're working with our body, but we're also breathing in the air around us and we're breathing out. So it's a very natural motion. We don't manipulate the breath or shorten or lengthen it in any way. It's just your natural breath. The third part of the technique has to do with working with thoughts or mind. And as I mentioned, thoughts just come up on their own all the time. You'll find sometimes you'll be thinking a lot, and other times it's just maybe a subtle stream in the background. And maybe sometimes there's just a gap there. An opening. So when you notice that you're thinking, you're actually already back at that moment. But there is a slight question mark in that if there's something you're really contemplating and you're chewing on, you may hesitate coming back. But at this stage of our practice, we just let go. And that's also part of the equanimity. Whatever arises, it doesn't matter. We just let go and come back. So come back to the breath over and over again. If you get confused or frustrated, just come back to your body and the posture, and start with that. And then you could go through the instruction for yourself. So we'll begin now. once you have settled into your practice a little bit, you can actually sharpen your attention on the breath. You can pay attention as the breath goes out. There's a gap at the end of the out-breath. The breath comes in. And you know, of course, that the breath is breathing you no matter whether you're paying attention or not. So it is really ultimately beyond concept. The breath happens, and that's your life force, your ability to stay alive, and your connection with the greater world. And that space that opens for you when you're able to just be with your breath is a teaching in itself. The open, spacious quality of the mind itself. So when you notice that you're settled down a little more and it's not such a struggle to be with the breath, then really relax into that openness, that gliding quality of the breath and the rhythm that's just happening. It's more like the breath is breathing you. And you're noticing. You should please stay seated. Just wanted to make a few comments about the Lojong practice that we are beginning to do. And this module, the first talk was last week, and that will be online pretty soon. So just to put it in context of where we've been in terms of our previous modules, Lojong falls within the Mahayana teachings, which is the great vehicle, the vehicle of emptiness and compassion. And just to review, last year we started with the six paramitas, which are ways of going beyond ego, you could say. They're generosity, discipline, patience, exertion, meditation, and prajna, which is transcendent knowledge. And that was module 15, if you want to review, back in the fall a year ago. And in thinking of this particular set of teachings we're stepping into, it made me think of how the actual theory of things is like having a car in the garage that you polish and you check the engine and make sure the tires are pumped up. And it's ready to go, but it really isn't heading out on the road if it's just theory. So we're now at a stage with Lojong, which is called mind training. It's very practical. And you've heard the phrase, it's where the rubber meets the road, and I think that's quite apt. As we say, the Mahayana is the great vehicle. So it's you can think of this as the vehicle where you're actually moving into the world and using your practice in a way that's very applied practice. Then we had a short module of two classes on prajnaparamita, which is the transcendent knowledge or emptiness. And after that, on module 17, we looked at looking at self and selflessness. So that was really a very intense module of the question of what makes up the self, and how we see ourselves as permanent or lasting, as singular, one thing, or solid, as independent, which is separate from causes and conditions. We're just, you know, we see ourselves as something. So we went into that quite a bit. And there's material, of course, in that. Module 17. Then we concluded with Module 18 in the spring called the Heart Sutra, which is the Sutra of Transcendent Knowledge. And that's full of a lot of no's, and we're going to get into some don'ts in Lojong. But don't worry. That could be another slogan. Don't worry. You'll be okay, we hope. So here we're moving from teachings on theory, to teachings on practice. And Lojong is the Bodhisattva path of practice and personal discipline. And again, it's the application of these teachings. That's the main point. It's really the application of the teachings. So within this practice, we'll be studying the absolute slogans, absolute bodhicitta. We'll learn more about that again. And the relative practice of bodhicitta, which is really, again, more the application in the world as circumstances come up, and how to apply your practice to any situation.
This is from a reading of the Profound Treasury, from the Profound Treasury of the Ocean of Dharma, the Bodhisattva Path of Wisdom and Compassion by Trungpa Rinpoche. Introduction to Mind Training. So far, our approach to the Mahayana has been a philosophical one, but to experience reality properly, we very much need an application or working basis. We need to change to a slightly more contemplative approach. This comes in very handy. We may have begun to understand the shunyata principle or the teachings on relative and absolute truth, but what are we going to do then? What are we going to do with those two truths? It is like we have eaten an immense amount of birthday cake. We are completely bloated and do not know what to do next. So at this point, we need to shift our emphasis from the theory of the Bodhisattva path to the practice and experience of it. What is the difference between theory and practice? Theory is an understanding of the possibility of egolessness, and practice is actually shedding your ego. The effect is relating with reality according to the Bodhisattva path. At the theoretical level, you can understand how the realization of the egolessness of individuality and the egolessness of Dharma can be achieved simultaneously and properly. And at the practical level, how you are going to do that is largely based on your practice and personal discipline. In the Mahayana, our main concern is how to awaken ourselves. The Mahayana takes quite a lot of effort because it is a big job. That is why it is called the Mahayana, the great vehicle. It is a big deal. The Mahayana is no joke, and you had better not fall asleep at the wheel when you are driving on such a big highway. But you can't go wrong with Mahayana heavy-handedness. It is the best kind. With Mahayana practice, there is no cultivation. You just do it. It's like taking medication. The pills you take might taste terribly bitter, but you take them anyway. The Mahayana is very harsh, but it is also very gentle. The intention is gentle, but the practice is harsh. By combining the intention and the practice, you are being both harshed and gentled. That process turns you into a bodhisattva. It is like jumping into a blender. You may begin to feel that you are swimming in the blender, and you might even enjoy it a little bit after you have been processed. The technique of shamatha vipassana does not change very much in the Mahayana. It is pretty standard. The only difference is the idea of an enlightened attitude, or bodhicitta. When you take the bodhisattva vow, you are actually transplanting bodhicitta in yourself. So bodhicitta is not purely conceptual, it is pragmatic. Out of bodhicitta comes the idea of working with a spiritual friend, or
Kalyana Mitra.
Thank you. As the guide for your practice. You begin to be willing to commit yourself to working with all sentient beings. But before you launch yourself into such a project, you first need lots of training. In that way, the Mahayana approach is similar to the Hinayana logic or Sosotarpa.
Tarpa.
Or self-liberation. The power and practicality of Lojong. Lojong is a way of switching allegiance from your ego to Buddha nature. It is a process of indoctrination in which your previous preconceptions are wiped out. Quite simply, you indoctrinate yourself into the Bodhisattva path and the Bodhisattva's way of thinking by realizing that you have in your mind this monolithic principle called Buddha nature, bodhicitta, or
Tathagatagarbha.
Thank you. You indoctrinate yourself so that you cannot get away from that. Getting a feel for the slogans. It is important to understand the structure of the Atisha slogans. Each of them fits into a certain section of your practice. That is why we have seven different groups of slogans, or seven points of mind training. Some slogans apply to your sitting practice on the cushion, and others apply to what happens before, during, and after that. The first slogan is about preliminaries to mind training. The second set of slogans is about bodhicitta, beginning with ultimate bodhicitta and followed by relative bodhicitta. These slogans have to do with simplifying your practice into the ultimate bodhicitta level and then applying bodhicitta and making it workable, starting with very simple things. Then there are the post-meditation slogans, which are connected with cultivating bodhicitta in your everyday life. These slogans are guidelines for transforming difficulties, working with both living and dying, evaluating your mind training, and developing discipline. They are general rules for how to conduct yourself. The teaching of the seven points of mind training is like being presented with a fish. You have the head of the fish, the body of the fish, and the tail of the fish, and you need to know which part you should cook, which one you should throw away, and which one you should debone so that you can have a good meal. Slogan practice is based on the six paramitas: generosity, discipline, patience, exertion, meditation, and prajna. Bodhisattvas, or would-be bodhisattvas, are like the knights of the medieval tradition. They are wealthy with generosity, and they wear excellent perfumes, so they feel good. Then they put on their armor, get on their horses, and ride. And as they do so, they have their weapons around them, their swords, and so forth. That seems to be the basic point of the six paramitas to become a really good warrior. In order to practice the slogans, your mind has to mix much more with the Dharma. Rather than studying these teachings as a scholarly exercise, you have to learn how to listen to the Dharma, how to study properly, and apply what you have learned. It does not matter if you can come up with a bright idea. What counts is actually knowing how to apply the teachings. If you keep working with the slogans, you will begin to understand the geography of the whole thing. It is like driving into a town. Once you understand the layout, you have no problem knowing which way to turn. You will know when to turn left and when to turn right. You begin to get a feeling for the town. If you had just memorized the names of the streets, you probably wouldn't get very far. But once you learn the geography of the town, you even know how to take back streets to avoid traffic. You can practice the slogans with the people you work with at your job, the clerk at the shop where you buy your groceries or your clothes, the driver who cuts in front of you, anyone you relate with. The slogans are always applicable, so you have lots of opportunities. People might have mistaken beliefs about what is true. They might disagree about whether human beings came about from karmic formations or were created by God, but that doesn't matter. What matters is the personal level, how we relate with people. What matters is whether we complain or we don't complain. When we cash our check at the bank, how do we relate with that situation? When we eat in a restaurant, how do we relate with that? Slogan practice is universal. The idea is to use the slogans in dealing with anybody who is around us, anybody within our radius, anybody who has some connection with us. You can actually sharpen your prajna by relating with people in this way, and they begin to respond to it. They begin to feel that something very precious is taking place. From a practical point of view, if you adopt these principles, things actually work out much more efficiently for you. Waitresses become more friendly, taxi cab drivers become joyful, and the shopkeepers more accommodating. If you are projecting something that is good and decent, people always pick up on that. It's great. You can practice the slogans on the spot whenever a situation presents itself to you, but you don't just say, now I'm going to practice slogan number 4. That would be absurd, because the situation may not exist to do number 4. The idea is that slogans arise in response to a particular situation. The actual words of these slogans bounce in my mind always, even in my dreams. They are very powerful and significant to me. Likewise, they could bounce around in your mind, in your dreams, before dreams, and in relationships with people. They should always be in the back of your mind. When your mind is tuned into such simple and beautiful words, these slogans arise naturally. It happens that way, rather than actually having to recall them like the Declaration of Independence. They are so innocent and absurd, in a sense, but their absurdity is so insightful. Slogan practice is delightful. It is very direct and personal, and everything is spelled out. It is much better than the moralistic approach of thinking that you need to stop doing something wrong. The slogans are not particularly traffic signs. They are reminders. And each time a certain slogan occurs to you, the slogan as a whole becomes more meaningful.